Hi, good afternoon.
Good.
Welcome to the Valentine's Day edition of the House Resources Committee. Time is, looks like 1:05 p.m. Members present, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Hawker, Representative Wilson, myself, Co-Chair Feige. Co-Chairs Sadler, Representative Johnson, and Representative Olson are both excused, and we've been joined by Representative Kawasaki. So, today's meeting is a presentation by our, I understand, sort of climatologically challenged sons, who, with Greek and Australian ancestry, really don't know what to do in the snow. So, this is why we have tourists in Alaska. I hope you guys are making it okay. Please go ahead and proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We should also note for the record that as residents of D.C. For the last 7 years, which closes down when about that much snow falls, we're very proud to have made it here today.
The committee extends their condolences.
For the record, my name is Jenik Mayer, partner with Analytica. This is now my third year before the Alaska legislature testifying on oil and gas issues. The last time we were here before this committee, both Nikos and I were here with the PFC Energy. We're now here with our own firm, Analytica, to continue the work we've been doing for some time now, looking at North Slope gas commercialization issues. My own background for the last 6+ years with PFC Energy, I've led the analytics team there working on fiscal terms analysis, project and portfolio economic modeling, building financial and economic models for transactions large and small, for national companies, international companies, private equity firms, as well as a range of analysis of the impact of fiscal terms on government investment, including work here in Alaska. And with that, I will hand it over to my colleague Nikos.
Thank you, John. For the record, Nikos Tsafos, partner in Analytica. My own background, last 7.5 years with the natural gas practice at PFC Energy, my responsibilities there included working with some of the world's largest oil and gas companies and advising them on, in particular, three main areas of expertise. One is companies that had gas, how to sell it, companies that wanted to buy gas, where to buy it from, and companies that wanted to understand what's happening in gas markets, helping them make sense of that, whether at a local, national, or regional level. And this is my second year engaged in advising the state legislature. Very happy to be here. With that introduction, we wanted to focus really on two major themes here, recognizing that this is our first presentation in front of this committee during this this session, and so we wanted to focus on two things. One is this idea of in kind versus in value, this question of how should the state participate in the proposed LNG project. And secondly, we want to talk about midstream options and the role of, in the case of the MOU, TransCanada, in the project design. So if you were to look at the first line there, if LNG were oil in kind and value, price and cost exposure, all that is effectively HOA, overall project questions, and then the midstream options is really about the MOU. Okay? So we wanted to start off with this slide, and we wanted to find a way to relate the questions that you're faced with in gas and put that in terms that members of the legislature, but more importantly, members of the public, are a little bit more familiar with. So we started with this picture. This is a copy-paste from the Department of Revenue's Revenue Sources book, the fall 2013 edition. And it shows you the production tax calculation for fiscal year 2015. The reason we picked 2015, it's the first year that all of the production is subject to SB 21. And I don't want to go through the numbers. This is available. It's not our work. But I wanted to sort of focus you on the right. So 2015, the forecast is for oil, ANS, to be at $105. Okay. You have midstream costs of about $10, some marine transportation, some of the TAPS, and there's another. Okay, so you take 105, you subtract 10. Then you have lease expenditures, comes out to about $46 a barrel. And so you end up with a $48, $49 barrel at the slope that you get to tax. Okay? So this is this is the comparator, right? So this is oil. You're familiar with this. You've been looking at these numbers for a very, very long time. This is oil. So what we wanted to ask, well, what does this thing look like for gas? How do we think about that? So the next slide, slide 5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Do we want to have questions as we go through?
Sure.
Thank you. The indication here is 35% of the production tax value. However, it doesn't include the credits, and those are going to be very significantly different than what appears here, especially as prices decline. So I'm afraid we're looking at something that is only partial picture. So do you have the rest of that picture? I didn't see it further on.
Representative Sidon, for the chair, if I could answer that. For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. Because the purpose of this is not particularly to talk about oil taxes, but to take one particular section of things and compare how this calculation might work to what the picture looks like under gas, we've deliberately not looked at the credit side of things because we're really trying to focus on the question of where is value in the barrel. The aim of the exercise isn't to say how much tax does the state collect at the end of the day from oil. The aim is simply to say, as I think we'll show on the following slides, this is how gas compares to oil. And rather than get into the question of, well, how much of a future development cost would be attributed to oil versus to gas and what credits would be involved and what credits would actually apply to gas, because at the moment none do, we simply cut the calculation off at the tax before credits because that's what we want to concentrate on.
And I'm confused then where you use different prices of oil, because we're talking about the public and the public understanding what's, you know, what is apparent values. And if you calculate this at $81 a barrel, you get a very different picture on oil value to the state than if it's at $105 a barrel. So at some point in time, Mr. Chairman, I would like that also put into context here so that we in the public actually get a value comparison, because we're talking about value at the end compared to oil, but if we don't have the value compared to oil because we don't have a real price of oil or a real value to the state of oil at those prices, then we're kind of in never-never land.
Through the chair, Nikos Safos and Aluka, you're absolutely right. And what we would like to do, if that's okay, is walk you through why we put those numbers there and see if it makes sense. Part of what we wanted to do was to offer a view at the 30 or 40,000 foot level to begin with before we start drilling down, in part because we want to make sure that everyone spends their time focused on the things that are the biggest and have the biggest impact for the state. So if having gone through the presentation, we still haven't quite gotten to answering those aspects, we would very happy to come back and explain why we are doing it the way we're doing it.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not opposed to going through this. I just want to make sure that since we are talking about gas as how that would compare in value to the state, and then we're comparing it to a system that we don't have, because we don't have a system where we tax 35% of the production tax value. We have the 35% less credits variable on the price. And so at some point in time, I just want to make sure that if we're supposed to be comparing somewhat value of gas to value of oil, you know, system-wise, we need to see what the system is that we have complete. So I just like at the end or in future presentation to get those values in there so that I understand that comparison.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Nikos Tafos, Analytica. Having had this familiar picture, let's kind of walk through and talk a little bit about how that would be different for gas. So the first thing is, let's begin with the first line, ANS oil price. Well, for gas, You're not going to have a price that's quite as transparent, that you can sort of go on the web and look at it. The price for gas is highly variable. It's highly opaque. It's not going to be quite as transparent. So that's one difference. The next thing is going to be very different by destination. We've shown you a couple of numbers, and we will show you some more, that really even within a country, you can have 20, 30, 40% variation between one price and another price. So you may end up, of course, with an average price, but in reality, you'll be earning very variable prices on this gas. The gas price is likely going to be linked to oil. Since you're going to be looking at Asia, most of the LNG in Asia is priced against what's called the JCC, the Japan crude cocktail. It's really the Japan customs cleared price. It basically is the average price that Japan pays for oil. And we did a calculation back to 2004, and basically JCC is the same as ANS. So I don't want you to worry about the JCC part for now.
Representative Hawker.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be clear that you're looking at the export scenario here, that we're not talking about linking any in-state gas sales or consumption to the JCC.
This is looking at the export aspect of
this.
Thank you. Without any, through the chair, without any prejudice as to what the domestic price of gas and how that will be set. And the last thing is that, in general, energy for energy, gas earns less than oil. So a $100 barrel is not the same as a $100 barrel of LNG. There are some contracts out there that get pretty close to that, but in general, gas trades at a discount to oil. The reason is that, especially in Asia, if you price gas more expensive than oil, consumers go back to using oil. And this has happened in the last 3-4 years where prices have gone so high and companies have said, forget it, it's not worth to use LNG on the margin, I'll just consume oil. So that is both a contractual as well as a slightly structural reality. So bottom line is, just because oil may be 100, you're not earning $100 of oil equivalent. Okay. The next part is the midstream. And there are three things to talk about here. First of all, the midstream is going to be higher. Why? Because, as we all know, gas is more expensive to transport than oil. Right? That's why gas is often stranded. It's more difficult to transport, more expensive to transport. So that 10 is going to be higher. The $10 for oil, the gas value will be higher. The tariff is not going to be regulated by FERC. And the tariff is really sensitive to the capital structure. So if you think about a tariff, usually it's mostly driven by two things. How much does the infrastructure cost? And then what is your allowed rate of return on that infrastructure? And so that's really what's going to govern the result. So those are the two main ways in which this calculation will differ. So let's kind of put some numbers there to show exactly what this means. We're on to the next slide, slide 7. So at $100 oil, we've estimated that the price could be 81. So this is the whole idea that you earn a discount. Now, I would like to underscore here, this is not really a forecasting exercise. We're not trying to go through and say every one of these numbers will be that. Hopefully by the time we run through the slides, the point will be apparent, which is to underscore that LNG is a very different beast than oil, and you have to think about it in a very, very different way. Okay. So at $100, you're not earning $100 equivalent, you're earning about 80, 81. Look at the midstream. Midstream could be about $66. Compare that to 10 for oil. So oil, you start from the price, you subtract 10, and then you're up in the slope. Here, you have to subtract 66 to get up to the slope. Then you have upstream. We've estimated a pretty low number for upstream. And then you end up with about $9 per barrel equivalent up in the slope. So the idea here is, if you focus your attention on how to tax 9, you're kind of leaving the vast majority of the barrel untouched. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's really the point here, is that 66 is so big that
ignoring it or saying that, you know what, the state doesn't play in that, doesn't play in GDP and liquefaction and higher price. We don't care. We are a tax levying authority at the wellhead. You're kind of leaving most of the pie outside of your control. And to just reiterate this a little bit more, if we go to slide 8, what if oil were to drop to about $90? And again, don't take this as forecasting. We're just trying to underscore how the mechanics work. At $90, you actually have no longer any value to tax at this low, because basically the entire value has been taken up by the infrastructure to produce the gas and bring it to market. Or what if, in the next slide, 9, you go back to $100 oil, but your costs end up being 12% higher. And 12% higher is not an unreasonable cost escalation. Things that are much smaller than this can end up costing 10% more than you thought. Again, in that scenario, you're back to zero at the wellhead. So what does this really mean if we go to slide 10? When you think about what really drives the value to the state, you want to make sure you get a fair price for the commodity. You would like to see if that 81, you can make that 85 or 90 or 95. You want to maximize that. But really, it's about the midstream. Midstream, midstream, midstream. That is such a big part of the pie. When you start from 81, if you are nowhere near that 66 in the middle, you're really missing out. Upstream is important, but not really as important. And really the point here is the wellhead, purely think about what you tax at the wellhead, is not really sufficient to drive the value for the state. If you look at the number again, don't get too caught up into it. 9 barrels times the production, you're looking at 370 million barrels, $370 million. So put that in the context of what the state earns from oil today. It's not really big, even though from a production side, at 384,000 barrels, this is actually a sizable production project, right? Because you're producing about 500 plus or minus, so this is almost 400. So from a volume, this is quite as big. From a value, it's so much smaller. So with that context, I'd like to hand it over to Janik and say, okay, well, let's take that more theoretical and let's try to apply it a little bit more to what it means for the state.
Mr. Chair. So on slide 10, this indicative tax before credit, ANS, that's at 100 or 105, or what's that number?
That's 100 that leads you to 81.
Okay, the 100 leads to 81.
I Where's the 81?
To clarify.
Oh, here.
Sure.
So oil is 100.
Oil is $100 a barrel. The barrel of oil equivalent is about 80, the price is about 81.
And follow up, perhaps? Yeah. And through this scenario, in barrels, what's that in BCF? I mean.
So through the chair, the 384 is equivalent to 17.4 million tons per annum, which is a little bit over 2 BCF a day, which is the assumption that has been put forward in the royalty study for the capacity and by the project sponsor. So as you know, the capacity of the project has a range from 15 to 18 million tons because of the weather. So it depends on how cold it is. You might be able to put more or less gas through it. So for the purposes of analysis, the companies as well as DNR, their consultants and us, we're making some kind of assumption about what this may look like. So it's about 17.4 million tons, just a little bit over 2 billion cubic feet a day. And again, this is about the export. Recognize that there's also a domestic gas component. So that's why the pipeline is going to be bigger at 1.5 BCF a day, because it's also going to be carrying gas that is not for export.
So this is calculated on 2.5 BCF a day as far as initial capacity, or is that final capacity?
This is the initial, through the chair, this is the initial capacity of the pipeline, and The pipeline, our understanding is looking at 2.5 billion cubic feet a day, of which about 2 or 2.1 will be exported. The rest will be carrying gas for the Alaska market. And both the pipeline as well as the LNG has the potential to be expanded in the future. But that's not really what we're looking at in this picture.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
And this pipeline is the AKLNG pipeline or the AGDC pipeline? The calculations on this.
Mr. Chair, this is the pipeline that is proposed in the HOA and the Memorandum of Understanding for bringing North Slope gas down to, and you can see, for LNG export, including the five in-state outlets.
Okay, thank you.
So that's the big one.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. So if we take that analysis and essentially look at something similar graphically over a range of prices. The prices on the bottom here are expressed in dollars per barrel of oil equivalent, that being an LNG price, not an oil price. So, as Nikos has said, $80 a barrel could reasonably, under a typical Asian LNG pricing contract, be $100 crude oil. But we've looked at this just in terms of the LNG price in dollars per barrel of oil equivalent. Again, doing the analysis in oil equivalent terms, because it's something that's much more familiar to people, we think, than talking in thousands of or millions of cubic feet or millions of British thermal units, keeping it in a unit that people are familiar with. And so what we see is if we vary the price, what we see is taking the core of the states take, that is the royalty and the production tax, things that the two most substantial components, certainly when we look at oil, in the state's fiscal system. If we derive our value from those components on the basis that they're currently derived, that is value netted back to the wellhead, royalty measured on that value of the wellhead and taken in this case in value, or in particular production tax based on value of the wellhead then netted back further for the upstream costs, that you get this interesting impact where the very high tariff that Nikos was talking about of the entire midstream component, both gas processing, pipeline, and liquefaction, means that changes in price are actually enormously amplified in their impact on the state. The state actually bears a huge amount of price risk, and the reason for that is that it's essentially the state's value, it's the value at the wellhead, the upstream, that is the absorber of differences in price.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Digesting this graphic presentation, it appears to me that you're really looking at 5 different price scenarios and how that destination price gets basically, where that economic pie, the destination price, gets shared along the way, all the way back to the wellhead. And I look at this, I go out to the right column, and I see that's $70, barrel of oil equivalent. I go up the column, and I see how it gets split out, and it looks to me like it, that column represents $70. I go to the $80 column and I go up, and on the left-hand side I see $80. The 90, I see it hit 90. The 100, I see it hit 100. The 120 doesn't go up and allocate 120. Why is there a differential on the first column?
Representative Hawker, you raise an excellent point, and it appears that it's mislabeled and should actually be 110, not 120. Our sincere apologies.
Thank you very much.
Keeping you on your toes.
Indeed.
And
I'll be honest with you, Mr. Chairman, and I wasn't trying to be a smart ass. I was, it really was, I thought I was missing something in the presentation.
Very valid question. Representative Seed.
And Mr. Chairman, is this the ANS West Coast, or is this the after deduction of the 22% or whatever percentage.
This is an LNG price expressed in barrels of oil equivalent. So after discount.
So
based on a pricing formula.
So, Mr. Chairman, to look at comparative prices, we would be adding $23 if we were looking at anything for.
Indeed, or the $80 per barrel oil equivalent relates, roughly speaking, back to that $100 barrel oil from the previous example.
Correct.
So what you see is there is enormous variation in what the state would get.
Totally lost.
In royalty or in production tax, depending on the oil price. In high oil price environments, there remains substantial value for the state to take in royalty and in production tax, but as the price falls, that value quickly falls away to nothing. And the value falls away much faster than the price itself is falling. The structure essentially is amplifying the effect of the price fall to the state's revenues. And the reason it's amplifying that is because there's this large fixed component, which is the tariff set on all the other pieces, which, whether it's a real tariff that actually this is a tolling facility that charges a tariff to move gas through it, or it's, in fact, as is more likely to be the case, an integrated project among the producers where they don't look at this as a tariff themselves, but for regulatory and legal purposes, we have to assess what the cost of that component is, and the process for determining that tariff is reasonably well established, and what's used for taps, etc. That is a fixed component, and because it's a fixed component, it's almost in that sense like the midstream gets its guaranteed rate of return regardless of what the price is. That value is always going to be there. It's the state share that has to take up the entire burden in that sense of a decrease in the price, which is why the overall effect of the structure is to amplify on the state's revenues the effect of a fall in price. Or correspondingly, the same thing would be true of an increase in costs.
Okay. And I guess my interpretation of this is makes a good case for being an owner of the project, because then you get an ownership of at least a piece of that guaranteed return on the graph. Okay, Representative Seaton?
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is assuming, I mean, it's a pretty high-level view, but if, as we discussed with the parties earlier, that those tariffs or those expenses could be shifted by the individual parties because it's not a tariff, then at some point in time I'd like to get a discussion of how someone having higher expenses or taking more expense as tariff or costs versus someone taking lower tariffs, how that would impact the state as well. We don't have to do it now, but I wanted at some point.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it's an excellent point. In part, if we come back to Nikos's earlier slides, in particular, slide 5. There's 2 points here, which is that throughout the components that make up the core of the value here, there is inherently much less transparency. There's less transparency in the gas world on the price because there isn't one quoted price out there that we can all understand. It's all subject to contractual negotiations in different volumes, maybe sold in different contracts with different pricing formulas. Some volumes may be sold in a long-term contract, some on a spot market. What the actual price is by itself is very, very far from clear. And then when it comes to the question of the tariff on the pipeline, not only as a pipeline for export rather than for interstate commerce, is this not a FERC-regulated pipeline from a tariff perspective. But there is enormous ability, subject to whatever regulatory constraint one can place on it, to vary that tariff through different capital structures on a whole range of levels. And it seems to us, you know, there have been enough battles over the last many decades simply on the TAPS tariff, when that represents $6 out of these days $100 barrel of oil. Mm-hmm. When you have a tariff for the entire midstream component, including liquefaction back to the wellhead, that's more than $60. Mm-hmm. It seems to us that that's a good reason for wanting a better solution to the question of understanding where the value is in that chain and aligning interests on how value is created across the value chain rather than fighting over which components accrue the value.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It looks like in the future slides you're going to go over the options that the state has been forwarding, you know, for us to for comparison. And so they've done the 25%, 75% as the debt equity. Are you in agreement with that structure? So just for me to know as we're listening to the rest of the presentation or throughout this presentation, are you going to have opportunities for us to question, you know, think about that a little more critically?
Representative Tarr, through the chair. The 75-25 structure is specifically laid out in the MOU and relates specifically to the question of TransCanada and TransCanada's interest in the pipeline and the gas treatment gas processing facilities. That, I think we would certainly agree with the administration and their consultants' analysis that in looking at the tariff on that component, the tariff is much more sensitive in almost all circumstances to the relative levels of debt and equity than it is to the specifics of, for instance, the return on equity that's allowed. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, 75-25 is quite an aggressive degree of leverage. So 70-30 to 60-40 are probably more typical mixes of debt and equity for setting tariffs for regulatory purposes. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, 75-25 looks quite attractive in general. One has to weigh out the other components of the deal, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Having said that, so you're saying that the 75-25 looks good for the state?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's correct.
You didn't say for sure which side you were talking about, so I just wanted to. Okay, thank you.
So if we take this analysis a little further and look at some preliminary results that we are getting as we commence our modeling effort that we will be taking progressively further over the next several weeks as we work through the different committees with the administration, with the administration's consultants. These are, as I say, initial preliminary findings, the first cut of our model that will be refined as we refine, in particular, some of the assumptions behind the model a little further. For that reason, for instance, what we've shown here are sort of low, mid, and high price without getting into too many specific details as to what exactly those prices are because, as I say, as we do further work here, we'll be refining some of the assumptions that go into the model and precise points and where they relate on a particular axis or where two lines cross over may shift over time as we do that effort of refining the assumptions, but the basic directional learnings that we're trying to extrapolate from these charts won't change. The basic directional findings remain the same regardless. So what are those basic directional findings? Following on from that previous slide, what this really shows is that surprisingly, and really in some ways quite counterintuitively, taking the state's, the value of the state's ownership of the resource that it gets in particular through royalty and through production tax, and taking those in kind as a gas share with a corresponding share of equity in a project, pipeline, liquefaction, so gas processing pipeline, liquefaction, looking at this point just at the HOA and leaving aside the questions that the MOU raises about specifics of ownership in the pipeline and the gas processing. The basic concept of taking the state's value in that it has from its ownership stake as a gas share rather than as cash at the wellhead determined on a netback basis, and taking that gas and marrying it up with a corresponding share of equity through the entire midstream component. When you think about that and what that involves, it seems to me sort of your first instinct is to say, well, that could be interesting. I can see the upside to that. But surely, by doing that, we're increasing our exposure. If we're, in particular, the whole idea of equity, right, is I'm making this investment, and I must be essentially making a bet that is long LNG prices, and if LNG prices go up, I'm going to do great because I have all this invested in this, and if they go down, I'm going to do worse. And quite counterintuitively, what this shows, and what the previous slide shows as well, is actually the inverse, that by taking value in kind, by rather than being a taxing and regulating authority, but being essentially a partner in this project with a gas share, with a corresponding equity share through the midstream, you actually have greater downside protection than you do in value. And that's because of what we showed on that previous slide, which is instead of having that big fixed component that is someone else's essentially in crude and allegorical terms guaranteed return on a portion, and the state's share of value from the wellhead upward being what varies with price, this is instead a world where value is distributed across an entire investment. And if prices go down, then one may make less than an optimal return, one may make not the return that one hoped for when one took final investment decision, but it's not a case where value suddenly goes to zero with a very small movement in price. So what we see here is that if we compare the two, in a world, and that the HOA sort of posits somewhere between a 20 and a 25% share of gas for the state, in a world of a 25% share of gas and a corresponding 25% equity stake in an entire integrated project, at low prices, as we can see, the value to the state of Alaska is higher than it is in value, but with a shallower slope. So the state is better protected on the downside, but actually gives up some of the upside of high prices.
Hey, Representative Wilson?
You're just going to have to say it differently. Because I can see here when we're looking at the state of Alaska, I can see that's, but when we're looking at the next one, it says producers. So are we looking at that from the producer's point of view?
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilson, through the chair, the first graph is looking from the state's perspective.
Yes.
The second graph from the producer's perspective, and the third from the federal government's perspective.
Okay. So the first graph is showing then that it's at approximately what is this telling us over here, this $100?
So the red line is the option of taking royalty and tax in kind as barrels and having a corresponding equity ownership in the pipeline and the liquefaction, and comparing that in the green line to the status quo, essentially, to tax and royalty netted back at the wellhead in value. And what it's showing is that the slope of that red line is shallower than the slope of the green line. So the red line, the in-kind world, gives you a less price upside when prices are high, but less downside when prices are low. The state is actually better protected against price risk in the in-kind world than the status quo in value world, which is in some ways a counterintuitive finding, which we think people should understand.
So you're also looking at the length of the line.
The slope of the line.
Okay. Through the chair, if I can take another crack at it. So what we're doing is we're adding up all the money. So in a way, we're trying to figure out, so if you take the three greens, the three lines, you add them up, it's all the cash that this project generates. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to figure out where is that money going. So this is a sum of all the cash. Every year, project delivers cash, and we're asking, well, how does this get distributed along the state, the producers, and the federal government in two different ways of structuring the project? Either you levy a tax and royalty in value, or you take the gas for yourself, and then you invest in the infrastructure and become a partner in the project. So in a crude way, if you think about it, the green line is the sort of status quo. If you don't do anything, that's sort of what the world looks like. The red line is if you pass enabling legislation to sort of play out the scenario envisioned by the HOA. So that's in effect the way to think about it. So green is what it would look like right now, and again, we're making some simplifying assumptions. And red is what is the HOA trying to do? Basically, the HOA is trying to switch the state from the green line
to the red line.
Okay. That makes more sense. Thank you. To me.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I understand the value, the $66 or more, the higher proportion of value in the midstream. But when we're looking at that, whether it's midstream and we've taken debt, whether it's 75-25 or whatever, most of that value goes out paying for expenses. That most of that value is not retained as profit above expenses, above payments on bonds, all of those things. So I'm trying to figure out where these lines represent the actual money retained or revenue that's usable to the state, not that's committed to the midstream equity portion that you're just repaying. I mean, if it all goes out to the mortgage, what the, you don't have anything to support the state.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, for the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. The charts you're seeing here are, as I said, preliminary results from the model that, that we've got, but looking at cash flows over the project life. So not revenues, but total undiscounted cash flow over project life. So having factored in all of the initial upfront capital cost or the operating cost of maintaining that plant, for the producer's perspective or the other than tax and royalty, depending on which world we're in, all the other costs, taxes and other costs they need to pay, what is the ultimate cash flow to each of these three parties?
It's after mortgage, after you pay the debt.
And we include in the model a 70-30% capital structure. So, in fact, payments of both principal and interest based on that idea that, 70% of the capital is coming from debt have already been taken out of these cash flows, and these are levered after tax cash flows.
Just looking at, let's say, the producers there, at the low price, it looks like in value is at $70, which is more than the total value at $70 from the previous slide here. So, or is $70 not the low price?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. So on the previous slide, we were doing a stylized exercise of looking at a single barrel of value. On this next slide, we're no longer looking in this stylized way at a single barrel of value. We're looking at model results from looking at the entire project. And this is not a question of, you can see that the scale here is in billions of dollars. This is not value from one barrel. This is value from an entire 17 million ton per year LNG project over decades.
So these 0 to 160
billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars
of undiscounted cash flow.
Okay.
Finally,
one more question, Representative Wilson.
Okay, so what you're saying here then is that the swing, as far as your cash flow, if we took it out in a share of just the gas, it wouldn't be as, we wouldn't have as much at the top end, or we wouldn't have as much at the bottom end. But if we took it out in value, we would have more at the top end and we'd have more at the bottom end. Is that what you're saying?
Representative Wilson, that is entirely correct, yes. More exposure at both the top and the bottom. So more upside at the top and more downside at the bottom.
Okay, then, and so when we're looking at the producers, this is what the producers get or what we pay the producers?
What the producer gets in total cash flow from this project.
Okay. So, in value, so it looks to me like in value isn't as good for the producer as it would would be if we just took a share of the gas?
In Representative Wilson, through the chair, in absolute terms, that may vary depending on a range of assumptions. But in terms of the question of exposure on the upside and on the downside, in the in-value world, the producer is more has less upside, but is more protected on the downside. In the in-kind world, the producer has more upside, but is more exposed to downside risk.
Okay, thank you.
Finally, we should look at the third graph there in terms of the federal government. And what you see similarly is that, in particular in lower price environments, the federal government's share actually drops substantially in an in-kind world. There are a number of reasons for this, but the biggest one is that as in the low price environments, the state's share of the project, of overall project value, is relatively higher, and we will see a little bit more on the next slide as to how that is. The state is not a federal taxpayer, and so the project overall pays relatively less and less federal taxes in low price environments than in high price environments. And to the extent that there is a transfer of value through the in-kind structure, a big part of the transfer of that value is essentially away from the federal government and to the state government and to the producers. Move on to
question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at these low price environment, the existing all the criteria that are in the agreement, in every case the producers, the minimum value is going to be $45 billion or so. If it's in share or in kind, in the in value, it's going to be $65 billion. So your analysis is that under all scenarios, low price, mid price, high price, this is a great project and everybody makes tons of money. Is that what I'm seeing from this?
Representative, sitting through the chair, as I said, these very preliminary results intended to indicate directional relationships of variables. As our work in front of all of the committees continues, we'll do a much broader range of scenario analyses, looking at a much broader range of assumptions, and show what the different risks the state could bear in different scenarios would be. The aim of this exercise is not to say, look, it's all great all the time. It's simply to say, looking just at one structure versus another structure, one structure protects the state better.
Through the chair, if I could add, Nikos Tsavos, Analytica. If you look at that producer, the middle chart, and you look at the red line, or even the green line on the low end, I mean, if you spend $45 billion or $50 billion to get 60 back in 30 years, that's not really a very good deal. So this is also, there's a time value of money here. So you have to think about it. So, this is...
this is net value after all of this.
Sorry, my apologies for that, yes. Take that back.
But it's still a significantly less return than at the other end.
Yes.
So that is exactly correct, and in fact that's a point that we get to on the next slide, which looks not at undiscounted cash flow over time, but at overall net present value of the project across that same period, and looking not in absolute terms, but at the share that each participant of that overall net present value is receiving. And there are a couple of things that stand out. The first is that when we talk about a 20 to 25% gas share and a corresponding 20 to 25% equity stake, it seemed intuitively like one should come to the conclusion, oh, so the state would be getting about a 25% share of the total value of the resource. And is that fair? As the resource owner, does that represent a good deal or a bad deal for the state of Alaska? In fact, what we see is that despite only having a 25% share of the gas and 25% stake in the project, not only does the state of Alaska in most circumstances have substantially more than 25% of the overall economic value produced by the project, but again, that relatively in lower price environments, its share of the total value that's produced, well, of course, that's a decreasing pie as the price goes down. The state's share of that pie relatively gets higher in lower prices compared to higher ones. And that there are a number of reasons for that, but a few of them are the fact that the state, while it's a 25% participant throughout, on an equity basis throughout the entire midstream component, doesn't have to foot the bill for any of the upstream costs associated the way that all the other producers of gas do. The state, in that sense, is a producer of gas without any upstream costs, as it were. The state, for most purposes, is not a tax-paying entity, whether it's federal taxes, whether it's state income taxes that it would be paying to itself, And similarly, one important thing to note here is we've assumed in that sense that the property taxes similarly are a state liability. So one could take issue with this and say, well, actually, there's some portion of that property tax, which at 2% on a $60 billion investment is not an insignificant amount, that would actually have to go to municipalities. We're sort of folding in municipalities in this analysis to look at the state overall, including municipalities in that sense, and saying, in that sense, the state's portion of this project is really not a tax-paying entity, and because of that, that's one of the key sources that means it gets to take, relatively speaking, a much bigger share of the value.
Representative Hawker, question.
Thank you. I thought I understood what you were trying to depict in this graph, but I'm having trouble with it. I think I know what you're trying to do. Are we not trying to say that if you take any data point along the way, low to mid high price, in each of these three people who at the end of the day end up splitting the economic pie, that at any given data point across that spectrum, this should add up to the whole pie? And this is where I am confused, is I'm looking in the hypothetical. Let's just take a look at that low pretend there's a data point out there where your curve lines commence. You know, and let's just, for the sake of argument, look at the RIK, and state of Alaska on that first chart, of that pie, we're picking up, say, 58%. We go to the next, and same thing, producers get 50, and the feds get 15. When I aggregate those, I'm getting more than 100% of the pie. And was I misreading how that graph is supposed to be constructed?
Representative Hawker, I don't think you're misreading, but if you would let me go away and look at the numbers and get back to you with an answer, because that is an excellent question.
I think there's a bust in the calculus somewhere here. Right, yeah, thank you. But that is the concept of how the graph is supposed to work. It seems to, intuitively, it's working on the RIV scale. You're looking here, but it looks like it's the RIK scales that have got an issue.
So the overall point that this is intended to illustrate is that, again, in all price environments, the value to the state of Alaska is more than the nominal of 25% indicated by the gas share and by the equity that corresponds to that, and that value comes from not paying upstream costs and not being a taxpayer, among other things. And so similarly, that's particularly the case in low price environments where, for instance, things like property tax would otherwise take a progressively larger share of the total pie that the state of Alaska doesn't have to cover. And in that sense, it's particularly in lower price environments that the state's overall share is the highest, and in some cases much higher than, for instance, the other 75% gas owners and equity holders.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, exactly the technoid point I pointed out absolutely does not at all contradict or cause me any concern with the conclusion that was just stated.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, thank you. And in particular, what we see again is that in particular, in sort of mid to low prices, transfer essentially of value also because of the presence of a non-federal taxpaying entity in this project from the federal government to both producers and to the state of Alaska. But finally, I'd note that in this particular case, this shows value to the producers in the in-kind world being lower than in value. That can vary entirely based on particular assumptions of the model, both in terms of the overall stake, whether that's a 20% stake, whether that's a 25% stake, and a range of inputs around costs and other things that we will show how that can change in future presentations. So don't take from that inherently in-kind is less desirable from a producer's perspective. This is just one way of cutting things.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, pulling back out to the concept and the conclusions to be drawn from the conversation here, we're showing three entities, federal government, producers, and the state of Alaska. Is this truly the sovereign, or is the state of Alaska's portion here reflective of the state of Alaska, or is it reflective of what our agent TransCanada would take, or should that be divided, or is this in fact everything that goes to the state's treasury?
Representative Parker, through the chair, this is looking solely at the in value versus in kind question, and that sense is reflective of the world of the HOA without considering the MOU at this point. We will be doing some analysis in the coming few days of the MOU specifically and of that portion of value. By providing some of that to TransCanada, what that means. One thing I would note on that front is that if we think about the overall concept of a fixed tariff and a fixed tariff creating greater price volatility and price risk for the state, that while there are many, and we will go through them, reasons that the state may want to enter into the MOU with TransCanada, I think there are some compelling reasons why that could be desirable. One point to think about is that inherently having a fixed tariff in the system does add back in some degree of price volatility that the in-kind arrangements in general are taking away.
But, Mr. Chairman, to my question, what's showing here is state of Alaska, I'm taking out the code words of HOA and MOU that, frankly, a lot of us don't even understand. We're talking about, I'm an accountant. What'd you give, what'd you get? Who gave it, who got it. What shows here as the state of Alaska is and will be split in some manner or fashion between the state and TransCanada, whatever that fashion might be. And frankly, Mr. Chair, that's one of our concerns here, is that a fair deal for the state of Alaska?
Mm-hmm. Very true.
Representative Walker, through the chair, that is absolutely correct.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. And just a second, Representative Seaton. Representative Kalsong, you came to us in the second half of this legislature, but the rule is apples, not donuts. So if you just so you are aware. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And AGDC, if they are, I'm not sure who's the owner, who's going to be tax exempt. This is all calculated on everything being tax exempt on the 25% that we're looking at. And is that necessarily going to be the case?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the first thing to say is I'm not a tax attorney and can't give detailed advice in that sense on exactly how the state needs to structure this in order to ensure tax exempt status. The state obviously has an ability to do that. It's maintained over many years an ability to, for instance, keep the permanent fund from being a taxed entity, although I gather not without efforts to the contrary by the federal government. What this does show is that a key part of the overall value, both to the state of Alaska and to the producers, that comes from the in-kind world. Part of that, in terms of value to the state of Alaska, comes through decreased downside exposure, but part of that comes through a transfer of value, assuming no tax liability, from the federal government to the state and to the producers. And to that extent, ensuring that things are structured in a way that the state does not incur a federal tax liability seems absolutely crucial to this endeavor. It's my understanding that one of the reasons for the particular way in the enabling legislation the subsidiary of AGDC has been set up is to ensure that a federal tax liability isn't incurred, but as I say, that is not my specialty and not something I can comment on with expertise.
Fair enough. Thank you.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos, and just to go back to Representative Hawker's question, the last section of this presentation about the midstream options, so we will focus on the question of the MOU.
Sorry, I can't hear
the last section of this presentation is about the MOU and transportation, so we'll get to that quite a bit about the splitting of the pie in a second.
Okay, thank you.
So before we go to that, if you go back at the very high level, what Janik has described to you basically says, in a world where you are a co-investor, the two things that matter the most for how much money you end up with are the price of the gas and the cost of the infrastructure. In that way, you are fairly similar to how an oil company looks at that. So you start off by saying, I want the maximum value for the commodity, and I want to produce the commodity at the lowest cost possible, right? So if you do live in that world, the two questions that come up are, well, what's the price going to be, and what's the risk to that price, and what's the cost going to be, and what's the risk to that cost? So the next three slides are trying to begin the conversation about how to think about these two questions. The first question is really about price, and we have two slides here, 14 and 15. The point we want to make here is that when you think about the price of gas, you sort of have to forget what you know about the price of oil, in the sense that in the price of oil, you can pick up the journal and you can look at the price of oil, and if it's down, it means you're going to be making less money. If it's up, it means that you're going to be making more money. Gas doesn't quite work that way. Gas is usually traded in long-term contracts, and usually the price is linked to oil. But just because the price is linked to oil doesn't mean that the relationship is the exact same. Okay, so just because two contracts are both linked to oil does not mean they both earn the same value. Let's look at this example on the chart. So this shows you Taiwan, picked on Taiwan because it's an important consumer, but not too big that you would have 15 lines and everyone would be confused and overwhelmed. So these are Taiwan has three main long-term suppliers, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Qatar. And it buys gas from those three suppliers in contracts that are linked to oil. So all the contracts are linked to oil. However, on the x-axis, you have the price of oil. On the y-axis, you have the price of gas. What you can see is that not all the contracts rise and fall together. So if you look at Indonesia, the yellow one on the top, that actually has one of the strongest links to oil. In a way, you have a one-to-one relationship. The more oil goes up, the more gas goes up by a similar amount. On the bottom, you see Qatar actually has a very different relationship. And in fact, at the same $100 oil world, Qatar is more at 6-7, whereas Indonesia is more at 20. Again, both of these contracts are linked to oil. Just because they're linked to oil doesn't mean they're the same contract. And then you have Malaysia, interesting case in the middle. So Malaysia, when it first signed the contract with CPC, which is the importing agent into Taiwan, they had that red line. So they were sort of similar to Qatar, a little bit better on the downside, but not that much better on the upside. And at some point they said, wait a minute, we're losing too much. This is not a good contract for us.
So actually what they went and did is they renegotiated. And so they moved it up to the blue line. So the lessons that we wanted to leave you with here, the key thing is really the parentheses in each one of these, which is the timing. What really matters is timing. When do you set the price? Do you set it at the top of the market, or do you set it at the bottom of the market? Because that's the price that's going to guide you throughout the process. Except if it gets really out of sync with reality, contracts have an ability to revisit. Right? So think about the fact that Kenai had been exporting to Japan since 1969. Right? So there's no way that you can ever write a contract that could withstand 40 years of oil price where the contract is just as good and just as reflective of reality every single day for 40 years. So sometimes you have to change things. But for the most part, that initial price sets, that initial signing sets the price, sets the relationship to oil, and actually also sets the conditions under which you can review. So you can't just say after you sign a contract, you can come back 1 month later and say, well, I don't really like the contract, let's change it. The way you write it, you restrict the ability to revisit, because otherwise it would be a meaningless contract. If you sign a contract that any party can change at any time, it's not really much of a contract. So there's a balance between flexibility and predictability. And the last part before we go to the question that I wanted to highlight is new contracts are sort of irrelevant. So if I have a contract, if the state of Alaska has a contract with Tokyo Gas in Japan, and then Australia goes and signs a contract with Tokyo Gas in Japan for half the price, your price doesn't get affected. There are multiple prices. The same way that Qatar, just because Indonesia has a better deal, doesn't really do much for Qatar. Now, if Qatar wants to sell more gas to Taiwan, they can say, wait, you're paying Indonesia this much, you should give me this much as well. So that's how you bargain. But just because you may be hearing other deals out there, the deals are useful for understanding what's happening in the market, but they don't affect you in the same way they affect you for oil, because you have a relationship that is codified in your contract, and what matters is that relationship. It doesn't matter what other people are signing out there.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, in trying to think through what you just said and make it something I understand, I think what is not what you're doing with this graph, with this chart, illustrating that in the value chain of LNG, which is predicated upon long-term LNG shipping contracts, and those are contracts that have some kind of price bases, they've got floors, they've got ceilings, that what's critical is not that these are objective, it's not like going on a spot market and you get what the spot pays, but it's the ability to negotiate those contracts that is so important. And respectfully, I mean, is this not illustrating the concern which we need to be aware of, where there's the, that this illustrates the argument against an RIK situation where the state has to go into the market, develop its own RIK, its own sales contracts, that we might be at a profound disadvantage again as a much smaller participant in the market world against the producers who have, you know, literally a, you know, a major international marketing system, as well as well, just the argument that the state may be at a great disadvantage against the much larger world players such as the producers. And is that really what we're getting to with this whole graph? That we have to have the ability to negotiate strong contracts, because we live with them, they're independent of anybody else's contracts.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, Nikos Tsafos, Analytica. The answer is yes and no, and let me explain what I mean by this. Yes, in the sense that it's absolutely critical that you get a good deal. It's absolutely critical that at the time you sign this, you get good value for your gas.
That's the yes part. The no part is a big driver of what you get is the market reality at the time that you sign it. Because what you get depends on what leverage you have. So if you are one of 20 suppliers or 30 suppliers, you probably don't have a lot of leverage. If you're one of 3 suppliers, you have a lot more leverage. So you're absolutely right that your ability to negotiate matters, but the market matters and sometimes can matter even more. Because if the market conditions are such, you can negotiate a good deal without necessarily having as much experience in negotiating. And the second part, if I could add to that, is if you look at the world of LNG marketing, I wouldn't necessarily lead to the conclusion that a bigger oil company always gets a better deal. Right? There, if you look at the pricing of gas around the world, there are a lot of times that companies have signed deals, even big companies, even some of the players that are here in Alaska, that they would probably 5 or 10 years later say, you know what, I wish I could have done something different. But at the time, that was the best I could get. And the last part of that is there are also multiple ways for the state to think about how it markets its gas to defend itself against that. So one option is for you to hire a bunch of people and set up a marketing team and start going around to Tokyo and trying to market that. Or you can say, hi, LNG World, I have 25% of 17 million tons. I don't want to go bother with marketing it. Who wants to market it for me, and what are you going to give me for that? So there are different ways for the state to protect itself against that asymmetry that I think you're talking about.
And just to that point, the HOA, of course, has that provision in it that the state certainly might avail itself of those producers that we're contemplating going into partnership with who have these global organizations, which, you know, just again gets back to my full point here of this entire concept is a very intricate and linked concept.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just kind of on along the same lines, you said that the specific time when the rate is set is sort of the most important. But what about the volumes and time, term of contract, and those types of things? And how are those impactful on the price exposure?
Sure. So if you, through the chair, Nico Sofs, Analytica, when you think about new projects, the term, the length, is usually long-term, which means in the world of LNG either 15 or 20 years. That, I would venture to say in your case, is probably what you should expect. There are certainly exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, to underpin that investment, you're looking for a long-term contract, and that usually means 15 to 20 million tons. Now, the volume part, there is really no answer to that. There are projects that might sell the entire volume to one player. Alaska LNG as a whole, not just the state as a whole, has probably too much gas for that. There probably isn't anyone out there that would be willing to take 17.4 million tons, and your partners probably wouldn't sell it to them because it's a little bit too concentrated of a risk. If you looked at how this played out, if you have basically 4 or 5 million tons of LNG, I would not be surprised if you only found one buyer, but I would expect most likely you would have 3 or 4 buyers that you would split that 4 or 5 million tons. Taking 1 to 3 million tons is a pretty average volume that companies may sign up for.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wilson, and then if I could ask committee members just to let these guys churn through the presentation as best they can.
I'm from what you have just said, it seems to me that the buyer, the end person at the end, they're better off trying to get several people too, because that will help them get it at a lower price?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, yes. So their interest is to have as many suppliers as possible. At the same time, they can't create suppliers.
Right.
Just because I really, really want it doesn't mean there are more people that are willing to sell for me, unless I'm willing to pay an exorbitant price.
Okay, thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, if I could add one thing in the response to your question, which is on the initial sort of purpose in some ways for showing this slide. Absolutely, it seems to me there are two things. Absolutely, one is the point you raised, which is that the deal that you negotiate and when you negotiate it and the market terms and all the rest of that time is crucial. But the other is that once that's done and that's set. And I think we have had a lot of questions in particular about, we hear that Asian buyers are increasingly interested in Henry Hub-based pricing, and what if Henry Hub, in the future, either Henry Hub or other more volatile price structures become the norm? Doesn't that expose us to a lot of downside? What if Lower 48 gas prices go through the floor, et cetera? And part of the point of this is to say, inherent to the entire LNG structure and process is setting in place these long-term contracts where once you've done the deal, you know what the deal is, and by and large, you do that deal before final investment decision, and when the actual time comes to put down the real money, you know what that deal looks like and what your exposure is.
For the record, Nico Safos Analytica, if we could take it to slide 15. The point we want to make here, and Representative Hawker alluded to this, and you saw that a little bit from the previous chart, is that there are ways for you to protect yourself against volatility. The typical way in which this happens is what's called an S-curve, which is basically just looking at the shape of the thing in the middle, which basically says, okay, on the far left of the chart, your price of gas rise and fall together with the price of oil. In the middle one, you say, okay, well, let's do that, but let's not go all the way. We're going to give you a little bit of the upside in protection for a little bit of the downside. And to understand how that plays out, you can go to the extreme where you place actually a floor and a ceiling. So let's say you decide that this project requires $12 to break even. And you say, you know what, we need to make $12. I don't care what happens, we need to make $12. And to do that, we're willing, even if the price relationship were to go to 20, we're willing to only take 16 of that. Right? So that's a way in which you can protect yourself. And the prevalence of S-curves really depends on, you know, who has bargaining power, the market fundamentals, but they are a perfectly legitimate means for companies as well as governments. Remember, governments tend to be pretty sizable investors in these projects, and governments care about predictability, a way to protect yourself against volatility. So there are a number of contractual ways you can reduce your exposure to pricing.
Okay, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you wanted to get through this. But in our MOU relationship, we're, you know, giving the responsibility of marketing our gas over to TransCanada. And so, you know, how can we be involved in this type of participation through that relationship? Is that already in the I don't recall those things being set in the MOU in any way.
Through the chair, the MOU sets a relationship up about the investment in the treatment plant and in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
In my reading of the MOU, there's nothing that says that TransCanada will be responsible for obtaining this price for you.
Mm-hmm.
TransCanada is merely a investor and a shipper of the gas through the pipeline. Mm-hmm. So they don't really take ownership of the gas.
Mm-hmm.
It's your gas throughout, even though you may be paying TransCanada a fee to use the facility.
Mm-hmm.
So this part here really is completely independent of TransCanada, because it doesn't really deal with the MOU, which is about the midstream portion, and that's where TransCanada comes in. And that's also where the last section of our presentation is.
And Representative Hawker.
And I've got a couple of questions. I'll limit it to one. Why does this chart labeled expensive projects can hedge against volatility? What's the substance or implication of that word expensive?
It, through the chair, Representative Hawker, it means that if you look at the last few years, the chief reason why companies have tried to use S-curves is because costs for LNG projects have become very high. And if we go to the next slide, which shows cost escalation, you'll see what I mean by that. Cost LNG projects was very expensive. And when you look at the announced cost structure for Alaska LNG, they would fall in that category of the more expensive LNG projects out there.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't any project desire to hedge against volatility?
Through the chair, not necessarily. Okay. Not necessarily, because if you take, for example, Equatorial Guinea, which we often talk to, Equatorial Guinea, when it was built, the operator Marathon said that they were able to deliver the gas through the upstream, the pipeline, and the liquefaction for under $1. So if I can deliver gas for under $1, why do I want protection on the downside?
It's the material.
I don't really think that it's going to be so low that I need protection. So if you have very cheap gas and you don't think the market is ever going to be against you, why give up the upside to be protected on the downside? So, and that's where the whole idea of expensive comes in.
Thank you.
And for the committee members, if we could let our presenters just kind of move through the rest of the presentations. If you do have questions, please write them down and we'll address them at the end.
Nikos Tsafos, Analytica. Slide 16, I don't really want to go through this. In detail, I just want to put as a reference. Remember big picture. What drives value in this project? Price and cost. You want the best price, you want the lowest cost. And so one of the questions that you will be asking is, well, how much is this going to cost? Right now you have an answer, well, maybe 45 to 65 billion for the whole thing. Well, that's a pretty big range. But the other part is, well, how do we know this is what it's going to cost? And so we wanted to show you here, if you look at the last 10 years or so, this is the type of delay and the type of cost overrun that projects, LNG projects, have faced. So one of the very legitimate questions you will ask is, if we're going to be the hook for 25% of this investment, you know, how high could it really go and how delayed could it be? And this tries to give you an answer, not by commenting on the specific project, but by just looking across the universe and say, well, what do these delays look like? What do these project overruns look like? Right. So that's the intention of this slide. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
I got that look in your eye, but I would just like to be on record as stating that, you know, one of the things that we've picked up along the way is that the assured failure of a successful of a mega project is being schedule driven rather than being driven by the project and the understanding and the development of it itself. And our inability to have the opportunity in public to drill down on these slides, I frankly think, is becoming schedule driven and not giving us the opportunity we need in public to hold these dialogues. But if that, again, I'm done for the day. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If we move on to the final section, for the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. We'll come back and at a future occasion come back to this question of the details of the memorandum of understanding that proposes that the state's share of ownership in the gas treatment plant, in the pipeline, though not in the liquefaction facility, be assigned to TransCanada with the option of the state to participate in 40% of its entire share that it hands over to TransCanada. We'll come back with some more detailed modeling results that sort of come to the things we were discussing before around upside and downside and what different arrangements mean in terms of value and split of value. But at this point, we wanted to sort of go through a little more conceptually what different ways the state might approach this and think conceptually about their strengths and their weaknesses. So while there's any number of different permutations of ways in which, and we should say when we talk about midstream here, we're really referring to a section of the midstream, meaning the treatment plant and the pipeline, not talking about the liquefaction facility. In terms of how the state could structure that, there are any number of different permutations, but we wanted to walk through a couple of obvious ones that seemed to us were worth thinking about. One, saying this is much more of an in-value world proposition than an in-kind world proposition, purely a producer project. The producers have all the gas. The producers would have, between them, their share of the pipeline, gas treatment pipeline, liquefaction. Another is to say, well, the state takes a share in each of these things, again, back to the sort of in-kind world, and this would be producers plus the state of Alaska. Or we could say this is producers plus the state of Alaska and some sort of third party. And if it's some sort of third party, the question becomes, well, we already have a third party involved through our history with AGEA. Does one leverage that history and continue as the path proposed by the Member of Understanding proposes? Or does one say, look, we want to find another way of terminating that relationship and launch a new bidding process for a new partner? And what are the strengths and weaknesses of each of these options? The path of the Memorandum of Understanding, of course, is that of producers, state of Alaska, and a third party with continuing the relationship formed by AGEA with TransCanada on different bases. So if we think about what are the core drivers for the state of Alaska in terms of fundamental interests, things that it wants to maximize, well, one core value is wanting to make sure there is as much alignment as possible between the producers and the state of Alaska. We've talked in the previous slides and shown graphically and numerically just how important that question of alignment is because of the question of the possibility of disputes over value and where value accrues. When just the pipeline and gas treatment portion, for instance, of the toll can come to, on this basis, $25 odd. Again, it's a big portion of the overall value. Again, that's in barrel of oil equivalent terms. It's a big portion of the overall value. And so that question of what the capital structure is there a tariff? What is that tariff? Can become very contentious if this is a producer-only project. And from the producer's perspective, there is actually no tariff. It's simply an investment that they make in infrastructure that takes gas from the North Slope and sees it ending up for sale in different Asian markets. But from a legal and regulatory perspective, there is a tariff inferred, and that tariff can be subject to all sorts of changes based on capital structure and what rates of return, etc., are allowed, and all sorts of possibilities for disputes about what that tariff actually is and therefore what value should be netted back to the wellhead. And so the question of minimizing those disputes, it seems to us, is crucial in the entire arrangement. Third-party expansion is clearly crucial to the state of Alaska. At the moment, there's 35-odd trillion cubic feet of proved gas up on the North Slope in the existing major fields, but estimated sort of more than 200 cubic feet of yet-to-find resource up there. That a big part of the aim here should be building infrastructure for the future to bring some of that resource to market. And clearly different players have different incentives in this. Some players are in this to monetize the gas that they have at the moment and may not be in this to monetize the gas of future resource holders in quite the same way. And so how that plays out is clearly critical to the state's overall interest. Clearly the state needs to make sure that in-state deliveries are enabled, that there is gas for in-state deliveries, and that in-state customers, again, have the lowest possible tariff. Clearly an interest in ensuring the greatest possible execution capability that the pipeline can be done on time and for the lowest possible cost. And it seems to us there's probably at least some substantial interest in ensuring continuity and momentum in terms of the work that's been done to date, in terms of the fact that after many decades of talking about possibly monetizing North Slope gas through different measures, that certainly for us as natural gas analysts, we hear our colleagues suddenly their ears pricking up and saying, you know, for the last 5 years I've been hearing possible ideas, but actually something real seems to be happening. And we look at what's going on and big producers are moving this project from their production arms to their development arms, and this actually seems to be happening. And so the question is, what's the value of continuity and momentum? And if one were to make a decision that sets back the process, what's the cost of that, and how does one weigh and evaluate that? So if we were to think about a producer-only pipeline, there's a couple of key weak points, which are questions of alignment and questions of expansion. As we've said, significant potential for disputes over the allocation of value and the question of what an optimal tariff is and optimal for whom. That if the state gets its economic value from the project from taxing value at the wellhead, there's a strong incentive to make sure that tariff is as high as possible, and a lot of avenues for potential dispute. When it comes to third-party expansion, clearly the overwhelming focus of the producers by themselves, without anyone else involved in the mix, is commercializing their resource. The way they make money is by taking that resource to market. And that doesn't necessarily give them a compelling interest in finding other resource holders to want to ship other resource holders gas through the pipeline, necessarily. The potential for disputes over allocation of value in terms of the tariff has an impact not just on the overall value, monetary value to the state, but also what the tariff is that's paid by in-state customers. They certainly have a strong and proven ability to execute. I don't think anyone would question that, although one should note that, to some extent, the midstream, and again, when I say midstream, particularly elements like pipeline, et cetera, as opposed to big projects like LNG projects, which in turn have more exposure to market upside than the pure regulatory monopoly type model of a pipeline, is becoming less of a focus for the majors. And finally, on the continuity and momentum front, all of these options, other than the Memorandum of Understanding path, as we'll see, has some degree of uncertainty, both around arbitration, litigation, what's involved in getting out of the AGEA process, and in terms of work done to date and what's involved in whether that can be maintained or not. If we were to look at a world in which this was the producers' equity participation as envisioned through the heads of agreement, but without anyone else involved. So the state took 20 to 25% of the gas, took a 20 to 25% equity stake, not just in the liquefaction, but also in the pipeline and the gas treatment plant, and ran and managed that stake itself. There are some strengths to this and some questions around the state's ability to manage that. Clearly, this will be a solution that creates strong alignment between the producers and the state of Alaska and gets rid of that question of, well, what's the tariff and where do we allocate value, and means that all of the participants are taking value fundamentally in the same way through the project. The state of Alaska clearly has a compelling interest in third-party expansion, and to the extent that it is an aggressive and effective pipeline company in this mix, it can pursue that and pursue that well. The question is, should the burden of that fall onto the state of Alaska? Is the state of Alaska well placed to be a strong pro-expansion pipeline operator, and does it have that capability? Because it would be the only participant in this project whose core interest is served by aggressively seeking new customers for the pipeline and aggressively seeking to expand the pipeline. And so the question is, what's the state of Alaska capacity in that front? Certainly, such a solution would mean that the state's equity-entitled capacity can be used to carry gas to local markets and potentially in terms of low cost of capital, low tariff, ensuring a low tariff for that gas. On the execution front, clearly for the initial phase of the project to the existing proposed trains, liquefaction trains down at Nikiski, strong ability to execute by the other partners involved in terms of the major producers. But any expansion would either be on the state of Alaska by itself or on the state of Alaska and any other new partners that it brought in for that expansion. And so the question of execution becomes more of one about future expansion than it does about the initial phase. And the same questions around continuity and momentum that come from what circumstances can one get out of the AGIA arrangement and onto this new project. Memorandum of Understanding has the same benefits as their previous one in terms of alignment between the producers and the state of Alaska. But the question becomes, is it the best deal for the state of Alaska if one is going to have another partner, not just do this in terms of the state's equity share being held by the state alone, but having some other third party involved? Is this particular deal with TransCanada better than or as good as any other that could be had? Well, when one looks at the capital structure used for rate-setting purposes, specifically on the tariff front, that certainly seems competitive with any other number of FERC-regulated pipelines across the United States. But if we don't actually have an open bidding process, how do we actually know that it's the best available tariff? Fundamentally, we never will. On the other hand, if one were to go out and open up to bids, there's no guarantee that one would necessarily get a better deal or even get the same deal. There are many uncertainties and a lot of judgment that needs to be exercised in evaluating what the best option is. In terms of having a capable external third party, it seems to us at least that one of the key benefits of having a third party involved is having a company involved in the entire process that makes its income, makes its living, not from shipping molecules to market, but just from shipping molecules. A party that's not interested in taking a gas resource and making its money by selling that resource, but simply making its money in the transportation process. Because that means that their fundamental interest is in expansion of the pipeline and in finding new gas to ship, because the more they can ship, the more they can make out of the project. And to that extent, if one has any questions about the state of Alaska's ability to play that role, the idea of a capable third party with a proven ability to execute has attractions, regardless of who that third party is. It should be noted in that sense that the pipeline and gas treatment facilities, pipeline in particular, are somewhat different from the liquefaction on that front, where expansion of the liquefaction, while there are certainly many issues to resolve and negotiate around greenfield versus brownfield economics and who gets the benefit of those brownfield economics. In principle, if you have enough gas for a new liquefaction train, you can build a new liquefaction train and it can have a completely different ownership structure from all the previous ones, and frequently new trains do. The molecules, however, are still going to be moving through the same pipeline. And so the question of expansion becomes much more critical for the pipeline than it becomes for the liquefaction project, which it seems to us is part of the rationale and the thinking, as we infer, the administration's thinking on the MOU and its focus on the pipeline rather than on the liquefaction. In-state deliveries, similar to the previous scenario, execution, clearly TransCanada has a proven and serious ability to execute major pipeline projects. And there's also an interesting relationship here where we've said on the one hand, one of the things that conceptually seems nice about the arrangement is the idea of a strong third party that wants to ship volumes through the pipeline rather than making money by selling gas, and the counterbalance of interests that places between TransCanada on the one side and the producers on the other. But at the same time, if one has a concern that says, well, any pipeline company simply makes a fixed rate of return on whatever they spend on the pipeline, so what's their incentive for cost control? Then it's also an interesting balance to say that may or may not be the case, but we do know that the three producers are going to care a hell of a lot about what the end, what the price of this pipeline is, because that determines all of their economics. And it's another area in which the counterweight of different parties and different interests could potentially serve the state of Alaska and its interests very well. Finally, on the continuity and momentum front, clearly this is an option that, that maintains the progress made to date and continues to accelerate investment, etc. So, on final option, which is to say, well, those arguments for a third party actually seem compelling, but we're not clear that this particular deal is the best deal. The questions here really are fundamentally around, well, is it possible to get a better deal? How competitive is the tariff, the cost of capital, etc.? Under this, it seems competitive, but will we ever know unless we go out to a competitive process? That's absolutely true. The downside to that is, will we necessarily get a better offer or even as good an offer through a competitive process? That's entirely unclear. And part of the way one answers that question probably depends on what one looks back at the entire AGEA process, the number of bidders involved there, etc., and how one answers the question of whether that was representative or whether one could have a stronger, more competitive process if one did it again. Beyond that, the only other core difference is that question of continuity and momentum. So the question is the possibility, but very far from the certainty, of at least finding out if there could be a better deal out there worth the time and momentum, etc., involved in terms of work done to date, in terms of cost, arbitration, etc., around the AGEA process. So finally, it seems to us that the state needs to fairly carefully weigh some key questions. In terms of AGEA and all the work that's done to date, what compensation might be involved in a different process for getting out, one that doesn't simply exit that through mutual agreement the way the Memorandum of Understanding does, and if there's arbitration, etc., involved, what's the potential liability there? Second question is how much, if the pipeline and gas treatment part of this process is slowed down or tied up in arbitration, even litigation, what does that mean for the overall heads of agreement, for the overall project vision and structure and negotiations with the producers, and does that pose any penalties on that? What are the odds of getting better terms than those involved in the Memorandum of Understanding? To what extent, as we said, was the level of competition that we saw in the AGEA process, which was not very high, representative of interest, and to what extent could one actually have a much more competitive process today? And if one could get a new tariff, a better deal than is on the table, would that compensate for instance, even if it's only a 6 or 12 month delay in the overall process, absence of an experienced player with an overall pro-expansion bias in their viewpoint from being at the table over the next 12 months as core commercial agreements, etc., are negotiated? It seems to us those are some of the core questions that the state needs to mull over as it thinks about the MOU process.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you very much. At this time, just for just so committee members understand, we'll continue with questions. And since Labor and Commerce does not need the room immediately following, we'll go as long as we have questions. So with that, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would we go back to slide 21? And on slide 21, down where it says execution, TransCanada brings execution knowledge, know-how, and expertise. I understand that. But it says, while producers reinforce cost discipline, but I don't know how they would reinforce that because they really don't care if we have to have a high tariff, do they?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. They care absolutely what the cost of the pipeline is.
But they can write that off.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that depends to some extent. For instance, if we do end up in this world of gas value in kind rather than through production tax, etc., there really, from the producer's perspective, is no such thing as a tariff on the pipeline anymore, because the state has its share of the gas and its share of the capacity and does what it will with its LNG. They have their share of the gas, their share of the pipeline, and their liquefaction project, and they do with it what they will. And these could, for all intents and purposes, be two completely separate projects. They share physical infrastructure, but their share of the gas goes from the top to the bottom, and the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, the liquefaction project are just one big capital investment from their perspective that enables them to take gas from the North Slope and sell it into Asia. And to the extent that the more expensive that is, the poorer their economics are, they care very, very strongly about what the cost of the pipeline is.
Okay.
And is it fair to note that, you know, although TransCanada, if they follow the plan here as outlined in the MOU, TransCanada will be administering the state's share of the overall project, but there's also three other producers that will have approximately a three-quarter share that are also going to have a significant interest in keeping costs down and making this the most efficient project for their own selfish purposes as well. So is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, that's entirely correct, yes.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the portion of where the value taken in the project is, your slide. I think it was slide 11. So if we have four different projects here, four different costs, I think our cost is, what, $75.25 agreement with TransCanada for that. We don't care what the producers do. If they want to have high return on equity, they'll have more equity in there, which will give them profit margin at a different phase than wellhead value delivered to the customer. So how do we balance and understand the difference of a producer in full control of the assumed tariff, but on the return on equity portion there, versus the value of leaving more wellhead value and taking it as a difference in wellhead value and market price versus taking it as return on investment in the midstream, which you're saying is the largest portion of their capital return on the whole project anyway?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, fundamentally the answer to that question depends on whether one is talking about an in-kind or an in-value view of it.
Well, I just to clarify, I understand the in-value and how if you were reducing it so you would avoid taxes, royalties, those things, and if those are all taken care of. But what are the other considerations that would be in there, and how would that impact the state if there's more value taken in the midstream than as a wellhead, especially if we are counting on them being sellers of our gas as well?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, if the state does have gas because it takes it in kind and participates, the question of how the different producers choose to structure their investments really becomes a question for the producers and the producers alone, and really is of no particular interest or relevance to the state of Alaska in the same way as it is if the state is taxing at the wellhead. Because from the producer's perspective, as they look at this, there really isn't a tariff in that sense. I mean, maybe they come up with one for some sort of internal transaction pricing purposes, maybe they don't. But overall, this becomes one project that is simply a big capital investment to take gas from the North Slope and sell it into Asia. And the state has its share and how it chooses to structure its share of that capacity, whether it does that through TransCanada, whether it does it on its own, whether it does that through some percentage of debt or some percentage of equity. those are questions within the state of Alaska's control that affect its share of this project. But once that, if one makes the decision to go down that pathway, it really is almost like saying, you know, while we have shared actual physical infrastructure, these could be two completely separate projects within the same infrastructure.
Follow-up, Representative?
Well, I'm trying to get a little further down the road and anticipating that we are going to use the producer's expertise in marketing this gas that's going to be on the same tankers leaving and everything else. And if they structure their project so that it has a higher or lower wellhead value than ours does, and those sales agreement, I doubt that they're going to be selling Alaska that gas at a terminal at a different price than the gas that's coming out of theirs. But how does that, how could that be structured to put our value chain at a disadvantage or an advantage? But I would assume that that would be the we've got to protect against a disadvantage price negotiation.
Representative, yeah. Through the chair, my colleague Nicholas may have some things to add to this. I would say once one is taking a gas share in kind and participating in the project, that question becomes one of one's ability to negotiate a deal. And that deal may be with end buyers in Tokyo and Korea and elsewhere. That deal may be with the three producers to market the LNG on your behalf. That deal may be with other major LNG marketers who are bidding competitively against particular producers, etc., to market gas on your behalf. But it's no longer a question of understanding where value occurs in the value chain. It's about the deal that you negotiate to say, well, we have LNG. We know that we have the gas from the time it leaves the wellhead down to the point that it's finished going through the liquefaction plant. And it's really just about saying, at that point, what will you give us for that LNG? You may not give us what you can potentially, you gas marketer can potentially receive for it in Tokyo Harbor, but what will you give us? And doing the analysis really solely on that portion of what premium are they getting for whatever risk they're taking on in being the marketer for this gas, and is that a good deal or not? It's not, the value of that is not driven in any way, shape or form by the capital structure through the rest of the value chain.
Well, I mean, I'm presuming that if we have three trains and we have LNG tankers going, that the most economic thing is to have combined shipments and not having LNG stored for a long time so that you have enough to get a separate individual tanker to come in. So if that was the case, and the wellhead value was different on the projects, how do you're saying that has no relationship because it's just how our leverage for making a deal and their leverage for making a deal in sales to markets overseas because for export.
Representative Stephen, through the chair. In the in-kind world, wellhead value isn't really the driver for anything because everyone has LNG. One can go through an exercise of deciding how that's netted back to the wellhead, but how that's netted back to the wellhead doesn't really determine anything because no one's taking their value at the wellhead. You could, for instance, take gas in kind and immediately turn around and say, you know what, actually, I don't want to have anything to do with the LNG business, actually I want to sell it at the wellhead. And in that case, maybe there's a question of, well, is the price that I get for selling it back at the wellhead similar to what I would get through some tariff calculation, or is that a negotiated price that's quite independent of that? But assuming that the state remains invested in the entire value chain and actually has LNG to sell, the value of that LNG is determined by what the end market will eventually pay for it, whether the state can market it itself, and if it can't, if someone else is doing it on its behalf, what premium they charge for doing that. It's not driven by the wellhead economics.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look back to slide 16, where it just has this snapshot of projects across the world. So just, you know, significant cost overruns on many of these. And I'm just wondering, is there a way that we can use this information to compare to the project as described that we're evaluating now to look for, you know, are there components that are similar, dissimilar, and might give us an indication of whether we're potentially going down the road of where we would see those same kind of cost overruns? And also, looking at that same one, the last project listed here was sanctioned in January of 2012. And does that mean that, is that just an artificial point that's shown in this table, or between January of 2012 and now February of 2014, were other projects not sanctioned?
Through the chair, Nico Stavros, for the record, there are some other projects. I wouldn't want to convey that this is an exhaustive list of every single project that's been proposed or built over the last decade. There are certainly projects out there that are not listed here. But let me take you to a bigger question about what does this really mean for Alaska. When you think about what makes these numbers, the last column, what drives cost overruns, there's really a number of things, but you can simplify them into thinking about country-specific, project-specific, or global. Let's use that very simple split. So global is, you know, you're going to put a lot of steel. Price of steel is determined. Globally, if steel is more expensive, you use more steel, it's going to be more expensive. So you could have a difference between the time you decide to make this investment and the time you buy the steel, you have to pay more for it. So that's a globally determined factor. And so we're definitely at a point now where a lot of commodities, including oil, are at historical highs or near historical highs. So it's really expensive to build things. In that sense, you're more likely to face an expensive project rather than a project with cost overruns because you know it's expensive. The second thing is a country-specific factor. So one of the things that happened in the bottom end in Australia is there's a huge boom in Australia, and you can make a great living going down to Australia and, you know, driving a big truck and make $120,000 to $200,000 a year driving that. There's a huge call on labor, and so wages go up, so you have to pay more for labor than you thought. So that's a country-specific factor. And then the project-specific factor, this is certainly true of Gorgon, and certainly true of Pluto. Pluto, for example, there was a fire at some point in one of the facilities. They had strikes with labor. In Gorgon, there were more delays because it's a really environmentally sensitive area. So there are things that can just go wrong as you build something. You think you're going to get it in time. It takes a little longer. You thought you had a route, but once you get there, you have to adjust. You may not be able to control all these things. So when you think about that universe, there are certainly things that are driving the cost of the project up before you get to final investment decision, so at least you'll know what the cost is and you can make an intelligent decision. Mm-hmm. And then it comes down to project management and having people that really know how to do this. And certainly the companies that are involved in Alaska are very experienced players. But as you see here, and we could go through the partners in these projects, a lot of very experienced players in these partners, right? So there's nothing magical about it. It's just usually better to have an experienced partner than a non-experienced partner. But having an experienced partner is not a foolproof protection against potential cost overruns. So what I think you'll see happen for the case of Alaska is that as you get closer to making a final decision, you'll hopefully shrink that price. You can't really go to the board of ExxonMobil and say, hey, we're going to invest on something that could cost anywhere from $45 to $65 billion. Oil companies would like to really shrink that range. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to give you a sense that even after we've shrank it, have an appreciation that things do go wrong sometimes and things end up costing more. The last thing I would say, sorry for the slightly longer answer, the other thing to keep in mind here is that because of the way these projects work, what these do usually
is they reduce your rate of return. Because once you've built it, you don't need to spend a lot of money to keep it running. So over time, you still make money. You just, it may not seem as smart an investment in retrospect as it did when you make it. So you don't, I mean, you could, but you don't generally lose money, quote unquote, in the sense of a negative cash flow where every year you're spending more than you're taking in. Prices would have to go really low for you to get to that point. Most likely what happens when costs go through the roof is that you thought you're going to make 15% return, you make 10 or you make 8. So that's usually the way that the risk plays out. Again, not to make an absolute statement, but that's usually how it plays out in LNG.
Okay, follow up, Representative Torres.
Oh, thank you. Well, just and kind of in thinking about that and how to structure this, when you talk with TransCanada, you know, they'll say that they're a good partner because not only are they a pipeline builder, but they're an operator as well. And so looking at those last pages where you're kind of, you know, giving our sort of risk-reward kind of analysis and things that need to align, virtually all the items are, you know, aligned under a scenario where you would terminate AGEA and go out to bid. But, you know, what kind of uncertainty, I guess, or could you comment on, you know, that possibility and what that would mean for the relationships to bring in? Then you'd have another partner that potentially would be the builder of the pipeline, and then a later partner that would be an operator, and just that kind of structure versus what we're considering now.
Representative Ta, through the chair, and for the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. It seems to me, I think to both of us here, something that the state needs to weigh carefully in terms of what realistic chance does the state think that it might have, if the overall question of tariff, for instance, is the paramount question, what realistic chance is there of a better deal on that front versus what does the state think the cost is of either arbitration or another messier exit to the GA process, et cetera, plus delay? And then I think it seems to me the other question is looking at the memorandum of understanding at actually just how many off-ramps there are anticipated within that. That if the precedent agreement and the firm transportation services agreement that the MOU outlines are put into place, what the MOU envisions is that TransCanada will go off and bear the state's share of costs, etc., in undertaking the pre-feed study. At any point during that time, with either 60 or 90, I think 60 days notice, but I could be wrong on that, the state can turn around and say, well, this has been great, but actually we'd rather go out alone or we'd rather do it with a different partner. And all the state does is it reimburses TransCanada its costs plus a 7.1% interest rate. And finally, at FID, again, the state has the ability for any reason to terminate the arrangement and say, that's been very interesting, but for whatever reason, we'd like to have a different partner, we'd like to either just do this ourselves. So that it seems when you factor all those things in, that question of are we definitely getting the best deal and are we certain of that right now actually in some ways becomes even less pressing.
Back to slide 16 real quick. You had a number of projects there that were either early or on time and on budget. The Egyptian T1, T2, T4 at Trinidad and Equatorial Guinea. Who was building those projects? I obviously don't want the Russians at 120% over.
Mr. Co-Chair, Nico Stafos for the record. I have a sense in my head about who these people are, but I would like to get back to you officially.
Okay, that's fine.
Because I don't want to. I can tell you that having worked with the key thing here is to distinguish between the oil companies or the sponsors. They're really the project overseers, and they hire an EPC, engineering, procurement, construction contractor to build. So they're
oil companies usually, so the project sponsors are usually overseeing someone who's actually building. Right. So in the case of Egyptian LNG, BG is the project sponsor, the largest project sponsor, but they hire a company, I believe it's Bechtel, I'll get back to you on that, to actually execute on the project. And having worked with some of these companies, both producers as well as EPC contractors in the past, several of them have tried to link this chart with themselves and try to point out that they tend to be better, cheaper, or more on time. And I have to say that I haven't seen something very persuasive about a very strong link between, you know, whenever this EPC contract is involved, things always go on time and on budget, whereas a different EPC contractor has a worse track record. But we can try to give you more information. And really, at the end of the day, for the EPC side, there's really about 7 to 10 players that do that. So it's not a very long list of companies that live in the world of building these facilities.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yes.
Representative Parker.
And I'll be honest, it's impossible for me to go back and recreate the conversation that was going on 45 minutes ago, so I won't even attempt to pick up there. Frankly, it would be so far out of context, it would be impossible even for me to ask the question. But to that end, looking at this presentation in its entirety, really it's your last slide here, perhaps 23, that becomes kind of a talking point. Are the four options that you spent a great deal of time talking about here, are they definitive and exclusively the options that we face as a state, or that we have as a state?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, no, they're not. There are other ways to structure this. You could certainly have a third party only, a TransCanada only, which is what a GA is. There's certainly other ways to structure this. The reason we presented that way is because when we were trying to list out all the permutations, we kind of got lost. There's about 15, 16. So that's why we chose that as a slightly simplifying version. But if there's any particular option you would like us to look at in more detail, we're happy to do that. But you're absolutely right. This is not an exhaustive list of all the ways. In some ways, you can even be more creative. It's possible to have different players being the GTP and different players being the pipeline and different players being the local faction. So it's not even that the whole midstream has to be the exact same ownership.
If you could provide us with that list, just in writing, not necessarily in a presentation, so it'll give us an idea of what we're dealing with.
Sure.
I might continue, Mr. Chair. I think that's a rather daunting request. Good luck, guys.
It would be a long list.
Yeah. And quite frankly, that's not where I was trying to go with this. I wasn't looking to tease out an entire list by any means. But you've chose these four presentations for us, and you know we're going to have apparently a very limited time to have you in committee here. Do you think these are the only four we should be concerning ourselves with?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker and Nico Saps for the record, and then Jack Mayer may want to jump in. Having looked at this, and the reason we went from the 15-16 option to these four, these certainly seem the most reasonable options. If you sort of think it out a little bit, it was sort of, we thought in our mind that having the producers involved was an essential part to bring sort of cohesion to the project. So once you take that as a given, then the question is, well, okay, is it just them or do you add someone? It's also possible, actually, in the memorandum of understanding, you have the state of Alaska as an option to acquire equity but not an obligation. So it's quite possible that you end up with producers plus TransCanada, no state of Alaska. And as we work through the economic calculations of the MOU, we'll try to show you what that looks like. So that probably is the option that is most possible in the world that you live in, which we have not included in this world, which is that you have the producers, and you have basically the world of the MOU without the state exercising its right to acquire back the 40% stake, or up to 40%. So that's probably the option that it would be worth to add in here. Thank you for that.
Can I continue,
sir?
And again, I'll make this short. I'll just limit myself to a couple of concerns, but I'd actually kind of need to go two different paths at the moment. So backing up half a step, looking at this field of four, acknowledging it's not the universe of alternatives, certainly, but it's the field of four. And I think my takeaway is going to be it was field of four identified by you all as places where we really ought to be focusing our attention. So, and I may not necessarily agree with you on that, but we passed that slide a while ago. Let's look at that option on the right, the producers, state of Alaska, and third party, which, you know, obviously you've identified as a worthy look. And as I go back to sort of the detail and that, you know, how you define that, that's terminating a GN, launching a separate bid, finding a new partner in that. How would that work in the context of the MOU provision that grants TransCanada basically a 5-year right to participate in any similar project on terms and conditions consistent with those in the deal in front of us?
Representative Holker, through the chair, if I can at least take a first stab at that, and for the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. I think it seems to us there's sort of two routes that could take. One is to say, well, this is an alternative to the world of the MOU. This is one that says, actually, we don't like the MOU, we want to do something quite different. Or it would be one in which, at a particular point at which, under the MOU, there's an off-ramp at which the state can say, it's been nice, but so long, doing something different at that point.
Okay, so the real internal to that choice is, excuse me, Mr. Chair, may I continue?
Mm-hmm.
Is an inherent assumption that the state, that the MOU itself is materially modified.
The first, Representative Hawker through the chair, the first option would be that the MOU does not come into effect because the conditions that would bring it into effect, mm-hmm. i.e. enabling legislation, and then ultimately its enactment through a precedent agreement and a firm transportation services agreement don't happen.
Right.
That those things do happen, and that the provisions that are in the term sheet that would determine, that set out those agreements, which entail exit ramps, are taken instead.
Exactly. And so, exactly, we would be not approving the MOU, but tentatively pursuing an HOA process, but without the MOU relationship.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, that would be one option, but another would be going through the MOU, but at a future point, taking the exit ramps that are within the MOU.
And then it's just, you know, last point for today, and it goes, but you know, this whole conversation and dialogue has been on alignment. Your presentation talks about it being midstream. And a lot of the same questions and issues raised here are really relevant throughout the project, from literally molecule on the ground to molecule at where it's sold. As far as the state's participation and the various players that might be involved, are we to presume that in the part of the project above midstream and the part of the project below midstream, the LNG and the, you know, basically up into the upstream, that we are to presume that the presentation as presented to us really has no options?
I'm not sure, so this is when I don't get
a chance to have the questions here in context, so I just I withdraw the question. I just would also then note that, you know, you raised a lot of good questions here at the end slide, which do go to the, I think, really to the heart of the question that needs to be answered is, you know, is the proposal in front of us, does it really truly represent alignment from the very beginning of a project to the very end of a project, and that this presentation is strictly on that midstream section. You know, again, it just raises questions about the alignment throughout the entirety of the project.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, let me see if I can take a stab at this as I understand it. I think the one part I would like to go back is if you sort of go back to the $66 in the midstream, actually it's only the $24 that TransCanada plays into, which is the pipeline and the GDP.
Certainly.
So there's clearly a bigger midstream
GDP,
pie.
Which is definitionally the midstream.
Exactly. So there's a bigger midstream pie than just what TransCanada is involved in.
Correct.
It seems to us, though, that if you look at, if you think about misalignment in other parts, for the most part, on the liquefaction facility, it seems to us there's alignment in the sense that every partner wants the lowest possible cost, and if you are a 25% equity owner in the liquefaction, you have a similar interest with the 75% owners, and you also don't have any disputes with them. So I'm not sure that the liquefaction is a great source of misalignment. I think there's some potential misalignment in the marketing of gas, in the sense that you're trying to sell 17 million tons of gas, and you're probably going to be knocking on the same doors. And this is true of any project where the gas marketing works in this way, that the oil companies compete with the world and compete amongst themselves in the project. So that, I would say, is more a fact of life and not a result of the specific project structure. There is one way to get around it, which is to say that all the gas goes into a pot called Alaska LNG, and Alaska LNG sells this gas to the world. Mm-hmm. There are certainly projects that do that. Angola LNG, the most recent project to come online, is structured that way. There's one pot, Angola LNG sells and then flows money back to the partners. That reduces any potential for misalignment. It's certainly possible. Our understanding is that this is not the current thinking of the partners of how to market this gas, but it's certainly an option to address some of the potential misalignments on the marketing of gas. And I think on the upstream of gas, I would suspect, again, without going too deep in the details, you and the producers have a similar interest in maximizing the ultimate recovery of the resource and the reliable producibility of that resource. So I think if you think about the bigger chain, the biggest source of misalignment would be on the marketing. And again, just trying to reflect on the question. And
to this end, and then I'm done, is you're talking specifically to alignment within segments of a project, alignment in the oil fields, the upstream, alignment in the gas treatment plant, alignment in the pipe, alignment in the LNG facility. But where I'm getting to is taking this into its totality, alignment within the entire value chain. Mm-hmm. And is not a value chain only as strong as its weakest link? So if we've got these misalignments within segments of that value chain, what are the consequences we should, and I'm not looking for a question, but I'll tell you the concerns on my mind are, how should we be considering those misalignment points that you've identified in consequence on the entire value chain, not just pointing out the strengths of this link, and this link, but oh, by the way, this link in the middle of that chain has some serious weaknesses. I think that's the question that's on my mind.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that's very fair, and I think if you look at that bigger, the whole project altogether, I would say that if you looked at if you call it the weakest link, there are probably a lot more weak links under the status quo than what is currently in front of you. Is what's currently in front of you eliminating all the weak links? Probably not. Are there different ways to structure this? Absolutely. I think the question is really, and part of what we've tried to show in these slides as well as in the LBNA session a couple of weeks ago, is that there are really so many different ways to structure this. So maybe the best way forward is to start talking about explicit weak links and specific aspects and think about how that affects the project, because really there's so many ways in which you can put these things together that it kind of gets a little bit, it could get a little bit chaotic. And I know it's already a little bit complicated to begin with. So if we can zoom in on some specific types of misalignment and specific scenarios, I think that would we'd certainly be happy to comment on those and tell you what we think about that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. And I know you guys got to get up to Senate Finance, so Representative Seaton, last one.
Thank you. And, of course, one of the questions I've had for a while is, you know, how many royalty and tax scenarios around the world, how many different countries have structured in-kind purchase, and what percentage do they get out of the process? And is our alignment in this process similar to the percentage of government take or in those projects? I know we got to move along, so you can get that back to me, because I didn't see the list here. I didn't see anything. The other thing I'm concerned about is the same thing on the alignment to get a project going, but I'm also concerned that we're just seeing something, and you as our legislative consultants are kind of giving us a take on that project that we're looking at, and I think Representative Hawker and myself at least are asking, are there other solutions out there that we should be looking at? Because you can't just look at one deal and say yes or no. I mean, I don't believe we should be doing that. I think we should be looking at, is there a better deal? I mean, when I look at your last alignment chart, or your last chart, your final slide, the one that has the most checks also describes AGEA, except maybe the part about the first one on alignment. Maybe that's not there, and the only reason we know that's not there is because there wasn't a response to open season, but there hasn't been a response to open season on this one either. So, you know, we're going forward, but I would like to see analysis of are there ways that we can do something that's going to improve the position of the state of Alaska in a gas line going forward, instead of just drilling down into this one thing and saying, do you understand it? Do you not understand it? And by the way, you have no options because this is the only thing that's on that you can consider. And so, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, hopefully we can get a response on this.
Mr. Chairman, can I add something to the, on the topic of misalignment, one thing, if you're putting together some scenarios for us to look at the five offtakes and just where misalignment opportunities exist for access for in-state gas. That's something I would hope to get a little more information on.
Hey, obviously, gentlemen, this is not the last time we'll have you in front of the committee, so we shall continue this conversation at a future date, and probably not too far in the future. So with that, we're adjourned. We'll meet again 17 February at 1 o'clock.